70 years with KBS World Radio, 70 years of Global Korea. Throughout the year, we celebrate the 70th anniversary of KBS World Radio with the voices of our listeners from all over the world.
KBS World Radio 개국 70주년을 진심으로
Congratulations on the 70th anniversary of KBS World Radio. Hi, I'm Young Kim, Director of Content at Radio Korea. I used to host Jae Hangang, the Korean language program for Koreans overseas on KBS World Radio's Korean service, along with Mr. Jang Eun, the presenter. It has already been 5 years since I left. In those 5 years, Young Kim has become Old Kim, and now I have a fancy director title here at Radio Korea, which I should thank KBS World Radio for. One thing that has not changed is my love and affection for Jae Hangang, and I cannot miss out on the opportunity to celebrate this important anniversary. I really miss working with all of you at KBS World Radio. I want to congratulate every one of the hardworking staff there. I miss you all, and I want to take you out for a nice dinner the next time I am in Korea. I miss you. Congratulations to all of you. Bye.
Seventy years with KBS World Radio, 70 years of Global Korea. KBS World Radio brings Korea to you wherever you are.
Hello, it is Thursday, May the 18th, and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. President Yoon Suk-yeol attended an event commemorating the May 18th Gwangju Democratic Uprising, and he pledged to uphold the spirit of the movement. We'll have more in news briefing shortly. A recent case of teenage suicide and a spate of other youth suicide attempts linked to an online forum has raised alarm. We discuss what might be driving this disturbing trend for our in-depth today. And coming up for Explore Korea, we look ahead to Buddha's birthday and related events taking place here in Seoul this year. We have all that and more on today's Korea 24.
Finally, 임을 위한 행진곡 제창이 있겠습니다. 모두 자리에서 일어나 함께 손을 맞잡고 반주에 맞춰 힘차게 불러주시기 바랍니다.
사랑하며 What you're hearing now is Marching for the Beloved, an anthem to honor those who fell in the May 18th Democratic Uprising in 1980. South Korea marked the 43rd anniversary of the bloody protests on Thursday in a commemoration ceremony. 국민 여러분, 5.18 민주화 운동 유공자와 유가족 여러분. President Yoon Suk-yeol spoke at the ceremony in the southwestern city of Gwangju, where the uprising took place. He again pledged to stand against any challenges to the nation's liberal democracy by upholding the spirit of the democratic uprising. Let's listen to some of his remarks.
If we are to inherit the spirit of the May 18th uprising, we must fight against challenges by those who threaten freedom and democracy. And for this, we must have courage in action. If we do not fight against the challenges from inside and out that push democracy to the edge, we will not be able to discuss the spirit of the May 18th uprising.
Joining us now is our KBS World Radio news editor, Koo Hee-jin, to tell us more about that ceremony and the president's remarks, as well as our other headlines of the day. Hee-jin, hello.
Hello, Jang-woo.
This year's official ceremony took place in the drizzling rain and was attended by lawmakers from both sides of the aisle, as well as families of the victims and, of course, President Yoon. What can you tell us of today's proceedings?
Well, arriving at the venue alongside the bereaved mothers of those who sacrificed their lives during the democratic movement, President Yoon delivered a speech and called for the spirit of the uprising to be upheld in the present day. During the 10-day protest in Gwangju in 1980, 165 people lost their lives, while hundreds died later due to injuries sustained during the violent crackdown by the junta government. Let's listen further to what the president had to say.
5월의 정신은 우리 자유민주주의 헌법 정신.
The spirit of the May 18th uprising is the spirit of the liberal democratic constitution, and it is a precious legacy that we must inherit. This is the core that unites us. And the spirit of the May 18th uprising is calling us to act and safeguard liberal democracy.
5월의 정신은 우리에게 자유민주주의를 지키기 위한 실천을.
Now, Yoon's remarks came as an assurance that the conservative government recognizes the political significance of the bloody democratic movement. The ruling People Power Party recently dismissed a party Supreme Council member for expressing his opposition to recognizing the spirit of the May 18th movement in the nation's constitution.
Yes, questions remain about whether the spirit of the May 18th movement will indeed be added to the nation's constitution, something that President Yoon had suggested during his campaign. But his attendance at the annual ceremony for the second year in a row is an affirmation of his commitment to acknowledge the movement, it seems, something his conservative predecessor had often shied against. So it does seem to be significant. It does seem to be symbolically significant.
Indeed.
Let's move on to our other headlines of the day now, starting with the international arena. It has been confirmed that President Yoon Suk-yeol will hold a summit with Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida on Sunday on the sidelines of the Group of Seven summit in Hiroshima. He will also hold talks with other world leaders there. Can you update us on the latest details that have been announced?
The presidential office just now released details of Yoon's itinerary, which also includes summits with other world leaders. According to the top office, Yoon will hold summit talks with Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and sit down for talks with Vietnamese Prime Minister Pham Minh Chinh on the first day of the G7 summit on Friday. On Saturday, Yoon will hold a separate summit with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, Indonesian President Joko Widodo, and British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. On the talks, Yoon will call for cooperation in deterring North Korea's nuclear and missile provocations and discuss ways to boost security cooperation for peace in the region. Cooperation in supply chains and economy will likely be a leading topic of discussions, according to the office. Yoon's summit with Kishida will take place on the last day of the G7 summit and in line with agreements reached during their previous talks in Seoul on May 7th. The two leaders plan to jointly visit Hiroshima's Peace Memorial Park to pay respects to the Korean victims of the 1945 atomic bombing.
And we are also expecting a trilateral summit, of course, between South Korea, the US and Japan as well. US National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said on Wednesday that they are trying to arrange a meeting between President Joe Biden, Yoon and Kishida on the fringes of the G7 conference. Can you tell us more?
Well, Sullivan made the remark as he responded to a question about the possibility of a meeting with Yoon and Kishida while speaking to reporters aboard Air Force One en route to Japan for the G7 gathering. Sullivan said that the three-way meeting is down to scheduling, noting that there is goodwill on all sides to bring it about. He said that if the US side can find time in a dense itinerary, it will try to arrange the trilateral meeting, but currently there is nothing to confirm. The security advisor said that the G7 is likely to release a statement that expresses concern about China's economic coercion and some kind of engagement between G7 leaders and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is expected during the summit.
Meanwhile, South Korea and Japan once again failed to finalize details of Seoul's upcoming inspection of Tokyo's plans to discharge wastewater from the crippled Fukushima nuclear power plant. So What's the latest here?
Well, the two sides held the second round of working level talks virtually on Wednesday afternoon after they had failed to reach an agreement in the previous director general level session held last Friday in Seoul. Despite 4 hours of discussions, however, they once again failed to reach a conclusion on the details. After the talks, a foreign ministry official said that consultation with Japan was not complete, adding that the two sides will continue to communicate via diplomatic channels after reviewing the outcome of Wednesday's consultation. Seoul previously submitted a list of facilities and information that its inspection team hopes to access, but Japan reportedly said that access to some facilities requires internal consultation and balked at the plans to inspect parts of the multi-nucleide removal facility, noting that it is not currently operating. The team is expected to make a 4-day visit to Japan for the inspection, scheduled on May 23rd and the 24th.
Let's turn to some other headlines now. The main opposition Democratic Party has referred lawmaker Kim Nam-guk to the Parliamentary Ethics Committee over a cryptocurrency scandal that compelled him to leave the party. All the while, the matter has been a source of internal strife within the DP. So can you walk us through the latest?
Well, the DP on Wednesday submitted a motion to the National Assembly Special Committee on Ethics, seeking a disciplinary action against Kim. The disgraced lawmaker is at the centre of a political conflict over his cryptocurrency transactions and holdings that were allegedly worth some 6 billion won, or around $4.5 million at one point. The motion aims to slap disciplinary measures on Kim for violating the National Assembly Act and the Code of Ethics applied to lawmakers. The motion was submitted hours after the party decided to take steps to refer Kim to the Ethics Committee under orders from Party Chief Lee Jae-myung. Observers believe he reached the decision in the face of growing concerns that the latest allegations surrounding Kim have driven the party to a state of crisis ahead of next year's general elections. And within the party itself, supporters of Party Chair Lee Jae-myung said the timing of Wednesday's submission of a motion to that ethics committee was favourable to fend off any perception that the party was neglecting its duties. Now, critics of Lee, on the other hand, are saying that the party should have censured Kim as soon as he had announced his intention to leave the party to show that his resignation was not intended just to save face.
And finally, heading to Washington, the nominee for U.S. Special Envoy for North Korean Human Rights said on Wednesday that she will work to hold accountable those responsible for human rights violations and abuses in North Korea. Can you tell us more?
Well, Julie Turner made the remarks during a confirmation hearing of the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee. The nominee said that if appointed, she will seek to reinvigorate accountability efforts at the UN and prioritize efforts to resume public briefings on the human rights situation in the North at the UN Security Council. Turner said that the human rights situation in the North is one of the most protracted human rights crises in the world, and that the regime's human rights violations and abuses are inextricably linked to its weapons programs, which are funded through the exploitation and abuse of the North Korean people. The nominee said that she will work with partners and allies, including South Korea, to re-energize international efforts to promote human rights and increase access to uncensored information in the North.
That's all for our news briefing today. Hee Jin, thank you for those headlines.
Thank you.
South Korea has the unwelcome reputation of having the highest suicide rate among OECD countries. But in recent weeks, there's also been a particularly disturbing surge in teenage suicides. On April 16th, a teenager live-streamed her death by suicide on social media. Then on May 5th, Children's Day, two more teenage girls were stopped by police from taking their own lives while live-streaming as well. In a further troubling detail, it was found that all three cases were linked to an online forum known as the Depression Gallery. To tell us some more about teenage depression and rising suicide cases in Korea, we have joining us today via video call child and adolescent psychiatrist Dr. Yi Zhuyang. Dr. Yi, thank you for your time today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
So as I mentioned at the start, South Korea has this very unfortunate reputation for the high suicide rate among the developed countries. But this latest surge in youth suicide has had even more people concerned. It has jolted the nation. What can you tell us about this recent spike in youth suicides and depression in Korea?
Yeah, it's a tragic fact, but it's a fact that we have to tackle with. The rate of youth depression has skyrocketed across the globe, actually, in the last 10 years, and South Korea has not been an exception to this trend. And today, I'd like to list several contributors to this trend, and please be mindful that people with depression are more likely to have suicidal thoughts, plans, and they are at a higher risk of attempting and dying by suicide. Therefore, I might at times use the term risk of depression and risk of suicide interchangeably. I'll list several of them. So the first one is the COVID-19 pandemic, and people were isolated and their freedom was limited around this time. And the students were put in a virtual learning environment involuntarily, being asked to stare into the computer screen. Because of this, the students were significantly more distracted. They're less emotionally attuned to each other, and social development was just stalled. A study has shown that in October of 2020, at the height of pandemic, almost 30% of Korean youth reported anxiety and depression-related symptoms, compared to 20% prior to the pandemic, which was already high. And one study reported that since the beginning of the pandemic, suicides among Korean women and youth have particularly increased. The other factor I'd like to mention is the increasing use of smartphone and social media. Studies have shown that people who spend excessive amount of time on their devices show higher levels of depression than those who limit their device use. Also, decreasing sleep time from nighttime device use contributes to a higher risk of depression. So spending a lot of time on social media can lead to feelings of loneliness and anxiety and depression. What a paradox. So something called social media worsening the sense of connectedness. So social media constantly offers self-esteem threats to its users. So many people are richer, like better looking and more fit. People are constantly fed with videos and photos that serve as reference points to identify oneself in the world, especially for young people whose identity is not solidified, are more prone to feeling bad about themselves. Note that in 2021, a Facebook whistleblower leaked internal documents detailing the fact that Facebook chooses profit over safety, which includes childhood mental health. So also, social media can be a source of cyberbullying, trolling, and other forms of online harassment, which can result in youth depression. If you want to understand what it is like to be a child in the age of social media, you can watch a documentary called Childhood 2.1. Lastly, I'd like to mention increasing academic stress among Korean youth. So since 2007, the leading cause of death among Korean youth has been suicide. And in a 2018 study, academic stress was described as the most common factor that drives Korean teens into attempting suicide. So South Korea, like other East Asian countries, are known for its intense educational system. Its annual college entrance exam, Sunung, has been considered as a key societal scoring mechanism, and it has created tremendous pressure for the students. Korean students spend twice as much time studying as their American counterparts, devoting more time after school and even on the weekends in private institutions, hagwons. And many Korean students morph into a test-taking machines when their real goal should be deepening their academic interest and preparing for higher education, like in college or grad school. And graduating from a top-tier college in Korea is believed to be the strongest predictor for obtaining a secure job, improving social status, and even helping with marriage prospects. So given the intense pressure coming from the society to perform well academically, teens report more stressed and negative emotions regarding education compared to their Western counterparts. Now, this cutthroat battle begins from preschool.
Right.
Preschools have English immersion programs, parents think.
Sure.
And the kindergartens fast track into studying middle school math.
Dr. E, we do have a limited amount of time, so we are going to have to, I think, move on to some of the more recent developments as well. But thank you for walking us through these various factors that are at play here. As I mentioned at the start, there is also this very concerning development found with these three specific cases that we mentioned and this online forum called Depression Gallery. Can you tell us what more you might know about this as well? I know you are based in the US. You are at the Harvard Medical School at Cambridge Health Alliance, and you are a child and adolescent psychiatry fellow there. But can you tell us what you know about this forum as well?
So I've been keep tracking of this news recently because it was quite shocking. So the term Depression Gallery stems from a Korean web service called DC Insight. It existed quite a while, even when I was in college. So this website consists of many forums called galleries, and each gallery is an online subcommunity under this big DC Insight umbrella, where anonymous users with a common interest gather around with minimal external moderation. For those familiar with the online service Reddit, the galleries are equivalent to subreddits.
Mm.
So this Depression Gallery is one where people with depression meet and write to each other. But some of its users have taken extreme measures and used this space to promote suicide.
Mm. Right. So it's the fact that one of the reasons that has been a concern is this promotion of suicide, whereas initially this forum was meant to help people, young people, to deal with depression and mental health issues.
Yes, that's true. So some teens might come here to gain more information or even in the hopes to listen to and be heard by other people. But this many studies noted there is always some individuals online encouraging suicide.
Mm.
This has been written extensively on the medical literature that they evoke peer pressure to frame suicide as a problem-solving strategy, and they begin idolizing the people who attempt suicide. This can be extremely dangerous. And when suicide attempt or death are influenced by the internet, we call this using the term cyber suicide.
Yes. Further exacerbating this issue has been reports that there's also been a very dark and twisted turn where people have been targeting some of these users as well, taking advantage of their vulnerable state to both mentally and physically lead them to further mental health damage and thoughts of suicide as well. It's a very troubling situation. Authorities are considering whether to shut this forum down even in Korea. But today we don't want to dwell on this forum specifically too much, but look at perhaps the more broader situation and try to discuss the roots causes of this issue. Doctor, as a child and adolescent psychiatrist, can you tell us more about youth suicide? Is it different from suicide for people who are older and who try to take on this decision? Are teens perhaps more vulnerable to these thoughts of suicide and depression?
Right. So this is a very thought-provoking question. It is quite challenging question since it's hard to quantify vulnerability. But to answer this question, let me assume that vulnerability here means the rate or prevalence of suicide attempts. So rate of major depression among teens in South Korea is higher than that among adults. It's about twice of a rate that happens. According to the Korean National Statistics Office, the rate of death by suicide between ages 12 to 19 was 3.9 per 100,000 people. That's data from 2019. The same figure was 17.5, so about four times per 100,000 people between ages of 20 to 64. So the rate of death by suicide in adolescents are about one-fourth of that in adults. So more depression among teens, but less suicide compared to the adults.
Right.
That's something I can summarize. And the characteristics of teen suicide are different from those of adult suicide in several ways. First is the precipitating factors. So teenage suicide in Korea are more likely be due to social pressures, including academic stress, bullying, and family problems, while adult suicide are more associated with financial and occupational predicaments. Second difference comes in methods. So the means used by teenagers are often more violent, and the rate of suicide completions is higher among teens than in adults. It is reported that about 70% of death by teen suicide were caused by jumping from a high place. Lastly, the difference comes from the planning. There's a greater tendency among teenagers to engage in impulsive and unplanned suicide attempts, where adults tend to plan out their suicide attempts more thoroughly in advance.
Okay, so then I'm sure you and other psychiatrists are making efforts to try to help patients, these teenagers who are thinking of making this sort of decision. But is there a broader way that we should be trying to tackle this issue as a society as well? Is this something that the government should be doing, or schools and teachers or parents? What areas do you think we are lacking at the moment to try and tackle this here in Korea?
Okay, that's a really good question. There are so many ways we can tackle this question, but the single most powerful method known to decrease the rate of suicide in a nation is to increase the citizens' access to mental health services. And that's what Finland government did back in 2003 when their suicide rate was surging. And now that the rate of suicide in South Korea has been highest among the OECD countries for many years, hovering around 28 per 100,000 people. The government has already implemented many strategies that has been successful in many other countries, but there are still room for improvement. And this makes government a need to collaborate with school, hospital, and mental health professionally more proactively. So what they should do is government should increase the reimbursement rate of psychotherapy. This includes play therapy, talking therapy, and family therapy. In exchange, psychotherapy training programs should be closely overseen under their care for quality control, because psychologists are currently incentivized to conduct often unnecessary psychological testing rather than to deliver psychotherapy. But these trends need to be reviewed and discussed. Other strategies that can further improve the access to mental health is called integrated care model. In this model, mental health clinicians, psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers don't silo themselves, but proactively move into primary care clinics and schools to work with pediatricians and teachers. So they review and regularly screen for mental health among students and teens, and suggest who will benefit from additional mental health services, and offer assessment and even offer brief treatment. And this model's result has been fantastic. It improves access to care, improves continuity of care, improves collaboration among care providers, improves cost effectiveness, so it can save taxpayer money, and improves patient outcomes, including lower psychiatric hospitalization rate. And also, the government should minimize the bureaucratic hurdles around the involuntary admission policy for individual at very high risk of suicide or homicide.
Right.
Government should more proactively advocate for these emergent admissions that can save lives.
Right. So apologies for cutting you off, but we do have to try to wrap things up. But in other words, you're saying we have to make therapy more accessible to people, both for people who are seeking for it, but also have the medical community to come to the people to make it more known about therapy as well, and to talk about mental health issues. Finally, Dr. E., just to wrap up before we go, what would you as a practitioner like to tell teenagers who are suffering from depression, or any listeners who may perhaps know a teenager suffering from depression? What do we say to them?
Yeah. So having depression does not mean that your willpower is weak. Don't listen to people when they say, just snap out of it, because the recovery process don't work that way. Sometimes we just can't do it. Depression biologically changes how your brain works. So this biological process makes it really hard to discover hope and think flexibly, adding challenges to recovery. That's why you need additional help, professional help. And mental health professionals will be there for you in every step of the way to the recovery if you reach out for us. Lastly, there's a hotline that young people can reach out to when there are mental health crises. In Korea, you can dial 1-388.
Well, Dr. E, thank you for telling us that as well, that final bit of information. We are going to have to leave it there. We've been speaking to Dr. E. Drew Young, child adolescent psychiatrist at the Harvard Medical School at Cambridge Health Alliance. Thank you once again for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index jumped 20.74 points, or 0.83% on Thursday, to close the day at 2,515.40. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also rose, gaining 1.70 points, or 0.20%, to close at 835.89. On the foreign exchange, the local currency strengthened 3-1 against the U.S. dollar, closing the day at 1,334.21. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next, it is our daily segment, Korea Trending, where we take a look at some of the other news stories that have been trending online. And for that, we have joining us in the studio now, Diane New. Diane, hello. It's good to see you.
Hello, Jango.
Okay, so what's the first story that you have for us today?
South Korea has a notoriously competitive job market. A report from the Korea Economic Institute in January this year explained that the employment rate for Koreans aged 15 to 29 is well below the OECD average. But one person thought of a way to try and improve his chances of landing a job at a prestigious company. According to the Bank of Korea and Financial Supervisory Services on Wednesday, a man allegedly got his twin brother to take a job in entrance exam under his name. Criminal charges have been filed against a Bank of Korea employee who made his brother take the Financial Supervisory Service recruitment test in his stead.
Okay, let's back up. Why wouldn't someone want their twin brother to take an exam for them? How does that work? Can you walk us through what happened?
Right, so the individual applied to work at the BOK as well as the FSS last year, but a problem arose. Both entrance tests were on the same day.
Right, okay.
Right. So he got his twin brother to take the exam at the Financial Supervisory Service under his name while he himself took the Bank of Korea exam. Both brothers passed the written exam, which meant it was time for the next round, which is interviews. This time, the dates did not overlap, meaning the man could participate in both interviews himself. However, after passing the final round of recruitment for the central bank, he didn't show up for the interview with the supervisory agency.
Right. I understand that the brother was actually already a qualified accountant, which is how he was able to pass the FSS exam too. So what happened next then? How did he even get caught?
Well, the allegations came to light recently when a person anonymously shared the story on the platform Blind, an anonymous forum and community for verified employees. Afterward, the BOK launched an internal investigation to get to the bottom of this. The Bank of Korea and the Financial Supervisory Service explained that they reported the man to the prosecution in order to closely examine this case. The bank announced that it would strictly punish the employee according to the results of the investigation.
Right, so I understand that people were tipped off, actually, after people who had gone through either job application process started talking to each other.
Right.
And that's when they realized that the individual was at both interviews.
Exactly.
They thought that was strange because they knew the written exam had been on the same day.
Right.
But yes, the gall for the twins to try and get away with this. Ultimately, they were caught.
Right.
But as you said at the start, it also shows how desirable these top jobs are as well.
And of course.
The brothers would risk something like that as well. Okay, let's move on to our second story. What do you have for us?
A controversial turtle ship, which cost 2 billion won, or roughly $1.5 million to make in Kwajae City, South Gyeongsang Province, has been sold at an auction. And the shocking amount the ship was bought for has been making the rounds online. According to Kwajae City on Wednesday, Im Jin Nan turtle ship number 1 was sold for 1.54 million won at an auction that was held on the previous day. That's roughly $1,100.
Right, so it went from 1.5 million US dollars to 1.5 million Korean won.
Yes.
So it was sold for less than a thousandth of the price it cost originally.
So
an extremely shocking amount. For our listeners who may not know, the turtle ship, it was famously used by Admiral Lee Sun-shin to defeat the Japanese invaders during the Imjin War in the 16th century. And this newly built ship was meant to be a full-size replica. Can you tell us more about why it was built?
Well, the ship was produced as part of the Admiral Lee Sun-shin project conducted by South Gyeongsang Province in 2010. This was a project that looked to create tourist attractions relating to the Admiral. Mm. As I mentioned earlier, a total of 2 billion won was used. The national and provincial governments invested in the construction. The so-called fake turtle ship drew controversy after it was found that imported wood was used in the production. You see, at the time of the construction, it was requested that the company in charge of building the turtle ship use wood from domestic pine trees. However, the company made a profit of 1 billion won by using imported wood for over 80% of the ship. That's around $750,000. Following the incident, the company CEO was arrested.
Right, so the company CEO was essentially caught for embezzlement.
Right.
Not only that, it was so poorly made that they tried to float it on water, but there were leaks, so they just had to leave it on land like a display.
Yeah.
So then why was the ship sold this week?
Well, Kwajae City officials said the ship was in poor condition from the start, as you mentioned, as important pine trees were used. They added that damage from typhoons and other effects added to the ship's deterioration. The city decided to put it up for auction as it was deemed to be not useful to keep. Initially, the ship was put up for auction with a starting bid of around 118 million won. However, after 7 failed attempts, the price plunged. It's known that the ship was sold to an individual on Tuesday, but information about who the individual is has not been released.
Right, and it's also unclear what they're going to do with it, because it won't be easy to move,
right,
and it's expected to fall apart if not moved
right
properly.
Nowhere
as well
to place it at all.
Exactly. The buyer reportedly said that they bought it just because they were concerned that it would ultimately be knocked down if no one did buy it.
Right.
So it's a sad state of affairs, really, and a sad end to what should have been a moving tribute to Admiral E as well. Okay, let's move on to our last story. What else has been trending today?
First, there was K-pop, then it was K-food, and now it's K-literature. Some of South Korea's iconic short stories, including Lee Hyo-seok's When Buckwheat Flowers Bloom and Kim Yoo-jung's Camellia, have been translated into English. According to the publishing circles on Wednesday, the world-renowned publisher Penguin Random House recently published The Penguin Book of Korean Short Stories.
Okay, that sounds interesting. Can you tell us more about the book?
According to Bruce Fulton, a professor at the University of British Columbia who was in charge of editing the book, this is the first time that an anthology of Korean literature has been published as part of the Penguin Classics series. The anthologies published by Penguin Classics are the most widely used textbooks for classes related to world literature, not only in English-speaking countries, but also in non-English-speaking countries. Professor Fulton said, "We expect this publication to play a significant role in sharing the presence and value of Korean literature with readers around the world."
Yes, Bruce and his wife, Ju-chan Fulton, are household names when it comes to Korean literature. They are renowned translators. We've talked about their translations often in Korea Book Club, and we interviewed them for Touch Base in Seoul back in 2021 as well. So that shows that this collection is in good hands. Are there any stories included in the book that our listeners may know already from our book club?
There are. Cho Jung-le's Land of Exile, translated by Marshall R. Phil, as well as Wings by Lee Sang, translated by Kevin O'Rourke, are two short stories included in the book that were discussed on the show before. Mm. And then there is also Kim Seung-ok's Seoul Winter 1964, which was also translated into English by Marshall R. Phil.
Well, it's great news for Korean literature that these works are getting recognized like this
for
in
sure.
this collection. We'll wrap it up there for today's Korea Trending. Diane, thank you for bringing us those stories, and we'll see you next time.
See you next time.
We continue on now to explore Korea, our weekly segment discovering some of the cultural, historical and travel highlights that the country has to offer. And for that this week, we have joining us on the line our travel and history explorer, Alison Needles from the blog Pinpoint Korea. Ali, hello. It's great to talk to you again.
Yeah, thank you. You too.
OK, so I understand that we are talking about a holiday that is coming up soon, and that is Buddha's birthday, a day which isn't just for practicing Buddhists, of course, but also a day for those who want to experience authentic Korean culture and history. So, Ali, can you tell us more? Can you give us some background on the day first? What should we talk about the history of the holiday itself?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a really important holiday, like you mentioned. And if you want to know how to say this holiday in Korean, Buddha's birthday, you can say 소가 탄신 날 or 부처님 오신 날, which translates to the day the Buddha came. Mm. And the holiday falls on the eighth day of the fourth month, according to the lunar calendar. So this year it will fall on Saturday, May 27th. And public holidays in Korea that fall on a weekend are always moved to the Monday. So be sure to check the schedule for restaurants, cafes, anywhere that you're planning on going on May 29th.
Right. In fact, the law has only changed quite recently, actually, that from now on, whenever Buddha's birthday or Christmas falls on a weekend, there will be a replacement holiday the following Monday. Previously, that decision had been made at the discretion of the government, but now that rule has been set in stone as such. So this year, right. as you said, Buddha's birthday is on May 27th, a Saturday, and so there is a day off on May 29th, Monday.
Right.
So something to keep in mind for our listeners who are in Korea. So Ali, tell us more. What makes a Buddha's birthday so significant to the community?
Well, it's a really special holiday. 15 million people go to pray at a Buddhist temple in Korea on a daily basis anyways. So you can imagine this special, more spiritual holiday allows people to reconnect with their beliefs and their community. But more than a religious festival, it's also a celebration of Korean culture itself. So many of the temples at this time host lotus lantern festivals with beautiful decorations and lanterns made from traditional Korean paper called hanji. And when you go to these temples at this time of the year, you can experience traditional Korean games, dance, music, and in some places, some incredible acrobatic shows with tightrope walkers. Other temples open their space with food and tea to visitors, particularly those that are in the countryside, and they know people have made the long journey to go and visit them. And also, it's not really only for this holiday in this date in particular, but actually a lot of temples start celebrating from as early as the beginning of May, and for some even in April. So you might actually get free entry to some of these temples while you're traveling around this month.
Right, I see. Talk to me a bit more about the lanterns, because some people may recall Buddha's birthday as synonymous with the lantern festival.
Yeah, it can be a little bit confusing. I think some people think that they're like two different things. But yes, the holiday is also known as the Festival of Lanterns. In Korean, the Lantern Festival is kind of, it's more specifically called Yeondunghwae. And lanterns are really symbolic in Buddhism because they symbolize enlightenment and the release and letting go of your worries and your troubles. So lighting a lantern represents the start of a new, bright future. And it's been a tradition in Korea, as well as many other Buddhist countries, for centuries. So when you visit most temples during this time, especially in Korea, if you look up on the inside of the buildings, you'll see these beautiful pink, white, red, yellow, and lots of other colored lotus flower lanterns. And you'll also notice some small paper tags hanging from the bottom. This is a space for donations, the people who are like patroning these lanterns to write down their name and a wish that they hope to come true. And you can do this pretty much in every temple across the country.
Right, so the Lantern Festival, a major part of Buddha's birthday in Korea then. And normally there are a lot of events and activities that the public can take part in as well. Can you tell us about some highlights related to the Lantern Festival that is happening here in Seoul this year?
Yeah, so the largest Lantern Festival and parade in the country, as expected, it happens in Seoul. Entry is free to every event as well. And the Lantern Festival runs actually from Friday, May 19th, so this Friday, until Sunday, May 21st. On Saturday, May 20th, is the parade. It starts at 7 p.m. from Dongdaemun Gate, and this parade will make its way through northern Seoul all the way to Jeolgae-sa Temple. There will be around 100,000 lanterns on display, so this is a sight you really don't want to miss. The next day on the 21st, there's going to be a kind of smaller scale Lotus Lantern event. There's also going to be playtime for children with these lanterns at 9 p.m. at Jeolgae-sa Temple, so they can see them light up and beautiful in, at nighttime. And don't worry, parents, traffic around the temple is going to be restricted during this time for everybody's safety. And from the 11th to the 28th of this month, traditional lantern exhibitions are being held all over the country, with some notable places being Gwanghwamun Plaza, Jeolgae-sa Temple, and Bongeun-sa Temple near Gangnam. And they'll demonstrate kind of more shaped lanterns, so people and places in Korea. So people are welcome to come. People are encouraged to wear traditional Korean clothes to these events and really just embrace this culture and celebrate the time together.
Right, and I do believe it is going to be a quite joyous festival this year, as it will be the first one essentially without pandemic restrictions as well. But as we said, it's not just about the lanterns. There are other things going on the day of Buddha's birthday, May 27th as well, right?
That's right. So this is a more sacred day, so there will be Buddhist ceremonies held at every temple across the country. The ceremony is known as Bongchuk Bop Yoshik. This is a kind of lighting ceremony to honor the reverence of the Buddha. And the same lighting ceremony will also happen at Gwanghwamun Plaza in the afternoon on the 26th. And this has a really amazing, very large lantern in the shape of a Sumon-ol pagoda of Cheongamsa Temple, which is a national treasure. Some people might recognize it. So I really strongly recommend stopping by Gwanghwamun Plaza on the 26th in the afternoon to check this out.
Indeed. And there will also be plenty to eat as well, right, Ali?
Of course, I should have mentioned this earlier. It's never a festival without good food. There's going to be food stalls, merchants, snacks, meals all over the place during the parade and around the temples. I really also encourage people to try traditional temple food at this time, which is great for vegans and vegetarians as well.
Okay, you mentioned a couple of key locations already. Dongdaemun Gate, where the parade starts. Gwanghwamun Plaza, where the lantern of the pagoda will be lit. And Jeolgae-sa Temple, where many events will be held. Can you quickly let us know the best ways to reach these destinations?
Absolutely. For Dongdaemun Gate, go to Dongdaemun Station. Easy to remember. It's the Seoul subway. Leave from exit 6 or 7, you'll end up right in front of the gate. For Gwanghwamun Plaza, you can go to Gwanghwamun Station, also easy to remember, and leave from exit 2. That will get you closest to the event. And for Jogaesa Temple, you will want to go to Anguk Station and leave from exit 6. So the temple is straight ahead, and it takes a left at the intersection. It's on your right, so you can't miss it. Just look for all the colorful lanterns.
Okay, we're going to have to wrap it up there, but we appreciate you telling us all about Buddha's birthday. I think it is going to be a special one this year. Ali, till next time, take care, and we'll speak to you again soon.
Thank you so much. I hope everyone's wishes come true this year.
Did you enjoy this segment? You can discover more segments like this throughout the week on Korea 24. On Monday, we bring you news from the world of sports around the peninsula. Then on Tuesday, notable guests from various fields join us and give us insight into their lives and work. Are you a fan of books? Then tune in on Wednesday for Korea Book Club, where our book critic helps us unpack works by Korean authors or written on Korea. Go on an adventure with us every Thursday as we take a look at Korea's hidden gems with Explore Korea. And on Friday, listen to what our film critics have to say about the latest movie releases from both home and abroad. We have all that you need, all in one place, on Korea 24.
We've come to our closing segment now, Morning Edition Preview, where we take a look at some interesting features or reports coming out in tomorrow's newspapers, namely the Korea Times and the Korea Herald. And for that, we have with us in the studio now our staff editor, Richard Larkin, to bring us those stories. Richard, hello. It's good to see you.
Hello. Good to see you too.
Okay, so what's the first story that you have brought for us today?
Well, the weather in Korea has been pretty hot recently. It feels like we're in summer already.
Indeed, it does.
So I have chosen an article written by Lee Si-jin that can be found in the travel section of the Korea Herald. The article has recommended the best places to see the sunset in Taeyang, South Chungcheong Province. It might be a good time to visit these places as the weather in the evening is not cold and it's before the places become crowded during the summer.
Yes, it sounds like a great way to spend an evening at the moment. Let's start with the first recommendation then.
So the first location is Gochi Beach. The article mentions that it is known for its tidal flats and it is a place where people can catch crabs and clams when the tide is low. There are a pair of rocks just off the coast that are a famous attraction in Korea. The rocks are called Halmibai and Harabibai, which means Grandmother Rock and Grandfather Rock, respectively.
Right.
The reason why they are called that is because of a legend of a devoted couple from Korea's Silla Kingdom who are unable to forget each other. The article says that visitors should take a photo of the sunset when the sun dips between these rocks.
Okay, it sounds very romantic. Where else can we go?
Next is Unyo Beach. Apparently, there are usually fewer people there compared to Gochi Beach, so it's a good place for people who don't like crowds. Apparently, it is well known for its stunning views, and a layer of water gives the beach a pretty mirror reflection. What's interesting is that the beach is also one of the best places to go to at night. That's because it is a great place to stargaze while listening to the sound of crashing waves. These are just a couple of options of places to see the sunset in Taeyang. The article includes more places.
Yes, it's been a while since I've done any stargazing, particularly because it's near impossible here in Seoul.
Right.
So that does sound very appealing. Okay, let's move on to our second story. What do you have for us?
So Peter Thunwald is an actor who will star in Netflix's upcoming rom-com series Exo Kitty. Our listeners may know this as a spin-off of the popular film franchise To All the Boys I've Loved. The actor sat down with Dong Seung-hwa to talk about his role and also why his character's circumstances are so similar to his own. The interview can be found in the Weekender section of the Korea Times.
Yes, there is a lot of anticipation for this series because, as you said, the film the original film, To All the Boys That I've Loved, that was a big hit as well for Netflix. Can you tell us a bit more about the character this actor is playing then in the series?
Sure. The actor stars as Alex Finity, an Australia-raised Korean adoptee. The article mentions that the character is a school teacher who searches for his biological roots. This is very similar to his own life. That's because the actor was born in Korea and was adopted by his Australian parents when he was 6 months old. Thunwald says that playing a character with a similar past was both challenging and enjoyable.
Yes, I'm sure it would have hit home quite hard. So Was that challenging at all, do we know?
So he says it was challenging. He mentioned that one of the main challenges was that the characters' experiences were very close to home.
Sure.
Finwald added that he prefers to play characters who are different from him because there is a distinct barrier between the role and himself. One of the experiences he was able to have was returning to Korea. When he came here to film the series, it was actually the first time he came back since he was adopted.
Wow.
The article explains more about how Finwald got into acting as well as his life as a Korean adoptee. And I think it's worth a read.
Indeed. And I think it certainly raises interest for the series as well. Okay, we'll wrap it up there. Thank you for bringing us that story, Richard. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
And that's where we wrap it up for our show today. Thank you for staying with us. We'll be back same time tomorrow. So we hope you can join us again then. I've been your host, Hwan Jang-woo. And thank you, as always, for listening. Goodbye.
KBS World Radio.